You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Family complications, intimacies, and dysfunctions often follow us and haunt us into adulthood. This is especially true when that familial story involves tragedy. David Berg was the child of divorce. His much-loved older brother, Alan, disappeared shortly after David graduated from law school and turned up later murdered by an infamous hitman, or at least it's alleged to be a murder by this man named Charles Harrelson, the father of actor Woody. The New York Times Review called David Berg's book, Run, Brother, Run, extraordinary. It's a memoir of his brother Alan, his life, his death, and the trials that acquitted his alleged murderer. It's published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it brings David Berg here today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Should I be saying alleged? Because although the way you write it, it's quite clear that you believe that Charles Harrelson killed your father. Since he was acquitted, your brother, I mean, he was acquitted. So doesn't that make him not guilty of the crime?
Listen, if I'd have been on that jury, I would have acquitted Harrelson. I say that in the book. There's no doubt in anybody's mind in Texas or people who know the case that he murdered my brother. But the defense lawyer was a man named Percy Foreman, who was probably one of the most famous defense lawyers of the last century. And he had, without going into too much detail, he had what he called his reserve or utility witnesses. And when defaming the dead person, in this case my brother, didn't work, he would bring on alibi witnesses to place his defendant 100 miles away from the murder. And that's what happened.
Now, you've taken a quarter of a century to write this book. You've written a lot on legal matters and other things. Did any particular recent event inspire you to look back now to evaluate what happened?
You know, I had a story I wanted to tell. I just never told it to anyone. I never spoke about my brother to anyone else. The thing that triggered it was starting to think about our family, starting in the early 90s, and predestination and how we don't change much in our lifetime, and how my brother was trapped in my father's ambitions and his thoughts.
Was this also an embarrassing story to tell?
No, it was not embarrassing to tell. I couldn't write this. I couldn't talk about it, so I could write about it. I've written all my adult life. It wasn't embarrassing, but it was when it happened. So it seemed like, you know, the hitman killed my brother. There is no organized crime in Texas. There was a lot of shame and sordid headlines.
Now, your brother was older than you.
6 years.
How were you close?
Very. He was more of a father figure to me.
How soon after your parents met was he born?
Well, he was. That's part of the book, actually. There's nothing truthful about my parents' marriage certificate except the fact of their names. I mean, my brother was born, I think I'd say about 9 months after they met and about 4 months after they married.
And what was your father's ambition at the time?
My dad was in medical school.
And he married your mother.
Yes.
And then he was kicked out of medical school?
Yes. That was a tragedy that he allowed to define his life, which is a mistake. You should define tragedies. Don't let them define you.
Why was he thrown out?
It's in the book in great detail, but
you can give us a short version.
I will. He was one of their best students, and to be accepted to the University of Arkansas Medical School in 1932 is to triumph over some pretty anti-Semitic odds. In fact, one of his letters of recommendation was from his chemistry prof, who said, "Unlike most of the Jewish students we've had, Mr. Berg is, I found him to be honest and upright," which proved to be ironic. He got kicked out for cheating.
Had he cheated?
Yes.
So would that have prevented him from going to a different medical school sometime after that?
He tried. He tried for 6 years. He was turned down right and left and finally just gave up.
And why did he cheat? It was just a matter of... this is around the time he's getting married.
No, actually, it was he married his senior year, and he had 30 days to go before he graduated, and he thought he flunked a surgery test and ended up trying to rewrite the test, and he got kicked out.
And then your brother actually was accepted into med school?
He was. He was accepted to the University of Texas Medical School, which also was kind of a triumph against serious odds because in those days they still had Jewish quotas.
Now, after your parents divorced, they did something rather odd. They split custody of their kids. Why do you think they decided on that strategy?
Well, my mother had a lot of reasons. You know, my brother had to finish the fifth grade. A boy needs his father. But none of that was really the truth. My mother thought my brother, if he stayed with my father and my father's then girlfriend, he'd run off the girlfriend, which might have worked, except my father and his girlfriend, as it were, stayed married for 48 years. So it didn't work out.
Was money tight for your mother as a single mother?
Yes. My dad never sent any child support, sent $100 in all those years, and it was tight, but we didn't feel poor. My mother enriched our lives intellectually. She challenged us, and she thought, to quote her, she thought we could do anything those rich kids can do, which the parents of rich kids could do, and everybody who drove a Buick to my mother was rich.
But at that time, anywhere in this country, a divorced woman was perhaps looked down upon a little bit. You're Jewish and you're growing up in Arkansas.
Yeah.
Was there a Jewish community near you?
Most of the Jewish community was related to me. We had a huge family there called the Bessers. And you're right, my mother was treated as a pariah because she was divorced.
Do you remember missing your father and brother?
I do. It came upon me after a few years, and then my brother came back into my life in 1952.
Because he was sent back to stay with your mother? You were the oldest kid in the family, because your mother had remarried?
No.
Or she just had a child?
No. Yes. My mom had another child, my sister Linda. And sometime in 1952... Alan had been sent off to military school, Georgia Military Academy, by my father and his now wife, his former girlfriend. And he escaped, followed his duffel bag out a rear window at the school, and came to Little Rock and sought refuge there.
Your mother had been pregnant when they got divorced.
Correct. She was pregnant with my sister, Linda.
So now your brother was the bad boy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a bad boy. You have to understand, he attended 13 secondary schools before he graduated high school, and he never had a chance to lay down roots, but he got kicked out of Little Rock. Well, in Little Rock Central, they frowned on him. He was the victim of rules against running crap games on campus, and he got in a lot of fights, a lot of fist fights there over racial issues because the influence of my parents, to their credit. We were all outspoken integrationists in a time when that could get you killed.
He got kicked out of high school, and then he left?
Which high school are you referring to? He was allowed to walk the stage but didn't get his diploma. He then went down to Beaumont, Texas, where my dad had opened a second plant. He was in the upholstery business and helped run it and graduated high school.
Did he get along with your father's new wife, Dot?
No. Alan hated Dot, and Dot hated Alan. It was terrible, and that's why he got sent off to military schools.
But your father's business was doing well until there was a fire in the factory.
A terrible fire, yeah. 2 months after I moved to Houston, I'd moved away from Little Rock. My brother pulled into the driveway and just screamed for me to come, and we chased down the clouds, which you could see from miles away.
Was there anything suspicious about the fire?
No. It started in a cotton gin, and there was a fellow who was mute who smoked cigarettes and pulled cotton out of there and started the fire.
And there was no insurance?
None.
That strikes me as a surprise.
Well, my dad had just bought out his partners, my dad and my stepmother, and they were cash-strapped, and he dropped his insurance.
So he didn't have enough money to rebuild?
No.
What did he do for a living after that?
Well, he ran various versions of the upholstery business, but then finally in the 60s, he and my brother went into the carpet business, and that was a rough business. It was a boiler room operation.
Now, he had hoped that you would go to med school as well, but You were a star in school, a winner of all kinds of awards for debate and rhetoric. So were you predestined to become a lawyer?
I was. My mom told me that I had said I was going to be a lawyer at age 8. Why, I don't know. But I wanted to be a lawyer always.
You reveal in this book that you tried to commit suicide once.
Yes, I did. It came at the end of a long period of silence from my dad, and I was a kind of a tortured, aggravating teenager. I was not easy as a teenager either, but as in most cases like that, it's very frustrating, and my brother actually saved me.
You went to law school, and about the same time a man named Saul Rogers offered your brother a way out of the carpet business. Who was Rogers, and what did he want Alan to do for him?
Well, Rogers was a part of an extremely successful family in Beaumont, the Rogers brothers, who had a statewide chain of optometry shops. And my dad had met them when he briefly worked in Beaumont. And what he wanted Alan to do was to act as a front man, if you will, on a gambling ship that had docked in Galveston. And Saul wanted to buy the ship or charter it, and Alan was going to run the business end of it. And it was almost 100% legal, which was always a percentage my brother could work with. And Saul had to have a front man because they owned part of Caesar's Palace, and he and his brothers could not own more than one gambling interest.
This sounds like an Elmore Leonard novel, not like a real
story. It was an Elmore Leonard life in some ways.
My guest is David Berg, has written a book called Run, Brother, Run, a memoir of a murder in my family. A key figure in the story is Frank DeMaria. Who is he, and how did he get involved with your father and brother?
Well, my brother hired him to run the San Antonio operation, and he and my father, DeMaria and my father, got into a huge business dispute. And when my dad would he came to Houston, actually, after Dad fired him, and Dad was trying to keep him out of business and was bad-mouthing him. And we started having red flags. We were pretty sure it was DeMaria, couldn't be positive, who tried to run Alan down the bayou, tried to run his car off the road. And also, I was at Dad's house one day when he called, and he started, DeMaria, and started calling and asking me about my father's art, and he was going to get it all, and so it escalated into the point where Alan and I begged our dad to just lay off, and he didn't, and that was a mistake. Ultimately, DeMaria was indicted as an accomplice to the murder of my brother, Harrelson, and the allegation was that Charles Harrelson had murdered my brother for $1,500 paid by DeMaria. Of course, when Harrelson was acquitted, there was no case to bring against DeMaria, and it was dismissed.
Now, you had just opened your law office when he disappeared.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get involved in, well, first of all, your brother didn't turn up for a while.
Yeah, Alan disappeared shortly after he came to my office. He came to my office in May of 68 when I opened it. It was this tiny little office, and he brought a box of gifts, like he brought, you know, reams of paper. He brought a Donald Duck eraser, and he brought a lunch kit with Roy Rogers and Trigger on it. And we had a great time that day, and he had wished me well. And I couldn't have become a lawyer without Alan. He's the one who talked my way into law school, and otherwise I don't know if I'd have made it.
And then he was missing. What did you think had happened? What did the police say?
The police wouldn't get involved. He disappeared of a evening in May of 68. He was not found for another 6 months. And it took George Bush, his involvement, our then Congressman George H.W. Bush, to trigger an FBI investigation about 100 days after Alan disappeared.
So you had to get the FBI involved to find out what had happened to Alan.
Ironically, what happened was that once there was some publicity about Alan's disappearance, the FBI and the local authorities sort of simultaneously started turning up evidence, and a former employee of Dad's actually called him and told Dad he knew what had happened.
Well, your father had offered a reward.
Yes.
So were you getting a lot of responses?
There were several responses, mostly people trying to scam him, including the murderer and his brother.
Now, who told you it was Charles Harrelson?
Oh, every authority in Texas, the rangers, the eyewitness. He murdered Alan. Charles Harrelson liked to murder people in front of people. He always had a witness with him. And so far as I know, anytime Charles Harrelson set about to murder somebody, he did it. And the eyewitness was a woman named Sandra Sue Attaway, whom I interviewed for this book.
And he was a hired gun.
Yeah.
So, because he didn't have anything against your brother.
He never met my brother in his life.
How long after the discovery of Alan's body did the case go to trial?
Alan's body was discovered in November, the beginning of November 68. Harrelson went to trial in July of 1970.
Does that kind of delay tend to help the defendant?
Always, always. Delay, you know, as a lawyer who's handled a lot of criminal cases myself, delay always helps the defendant. Witnesses go away, prosecutors lose interest, and so on.
And people were afraid of Charles Harrelson. Was it hard to select a jury?
That's a very interesting part of the book. Percy Forman disqualified probably 350 potential jurors, and it was easy for him to select a jury. He got rid of virtually all the Dow Chemical people near the city where the case was tried, all the Hang'em High conservatives, and the prosecutor was hapless. He just didn't know how to stop that. I can tell you right now that a third-year law student could have stopped him, but he had a great panel going in.
And here you are trying to establish your law practice at the same time that you're trying to deal with all this other personal stuff.
Yes, yeah.
So how did you get to know Racehorse Haynes?
Racehorse was the most renowned alumnus of my school, the University of Houston Law Center. And his nickname, Racehorse, as soon as he got in the courtroom, took on metaphorical meaning. Nobody could keep up with Race. And I began to follow him around the courthouse, stalker, if you will. And I had lots of spare time when I opened my own office. And I would go down to the courthouse and watch him try virtually every case for a couple of 3 years till my practice got too big. And then we would sit around in the cafeteria of the old Harris County Criminal Courthouse and drink urns full of coffee until he and I became friends.
Now, as a lawyer, you had to defend people who you might have suspected were guilty. Did that play on you emotionally when you thought about what had happened with your brother?
Well, not at first, but over the years it did. There's a difference between – it's hard to explain, and I've almost given up explaining it to people who say, how can you defend someone who's guilty? Well, that's a lawyer's – the lawyer's obligation is not to make a judgment, but to make sure that the client gets the best possible and fairest trial that the defense lawyer can provide.
Even when it's a client like Diane B. who killed her husband and dismembered him?
Yes. Actually, I talk about that in the book. Diana B. Shot her husband and dismembered him and took his body to California in garbage bags where she was discovered trying to kill herself. And I represented her, and when the full story came out, I think absolute justice was done. She had been bound and gagged for 3 days. Her husband poked her breasts with an ice pick, threatened to kill their kids. And finally, he thrust a gun in her hand and said, "You don't have the guts to kill me." He was wrong.
Now, you also wound up picking up a case that went to the Supreme Court, and you were just a kid.
I was 28. That was a wonderful experience for me. My client was accused of basically wearing parts of a military uniform during an anti-war protest. And in Houston, that was in 1968, that would have been a huge mistake. And he was arrested and charged with the crime of wearing distinctive parts of a military uniform. I got the case after the Fifth Circuit had affirmed it, and the lawyer representing Danny Schacht was his name, failed to file his petition in the Supreme Court. So what an experience.
And did you win?
I did. Also, in Diana B's case, you forgot to ask me that. In my own defense, I just want to let you know that.
Well, you've lost a few, I'm sure.
I have.
I suspect even Percy Forman has lost a couple.
The interesting thing is about Percy Forman is he tried more cases in a year, murder cases, than Clarence Darrow did in a lifetime. He rarely lost.
Has writing about this in detail helped you put everything to rest?
It's really interesting. My memories and much of my anger have disappeared onto these pages.
So do you feel you've honored your brother's memory?
I do. Yesterday I got a call from Kinky Friedman, my buddy down in Texas. Kinky Friedman.
He's been a guest on the show a few times.
Well, Kinky said he felt I'd made a folk hero of Alan. And that won't be true for everyone who reads it, but Alan was a Gadsby-like figure, and I loved that he said that.
I mentioned Elmore Leonard. Actually, the reviewer in the New York Times, Christopher Kelly, compared this to Cormac McCarthy.
Yes, I know. I'm sure that
And the reason he linked it is because you tell the story here of going to see the Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men, and finding it hard to watch it because Woody Harrelson was in it.
Well, I'd never been able to watch Woody Harrelson in anything. If he came on TV, I turned it off.
I'm that way, and I've had no personal relationship with him.
Yeah, I had a different reason.
David Berg is a writer and lawyer who's written dozens of political, personal, and legal essays and articles which have appeared in national newspapers and magazines. His first book was The Trial Lawyer, What It Takes to Win. And now he has written a memoir of a murder in his family called Run, Brother, Run. It is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.